This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's time for our annual visit with DNR Director Keith Cray. We have Keith on about this time every year. Last year, Keith, first of all, welcome back to the program.
Hey, glad to be here.
Last year, 2013, was looking very, very busy. You had a lot on your plate. It turned out to be very busy, a lot of major accomplishments. 2014 is going to, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, be even busier. But let's talk a little bit about some of the things that we discussed last year that have come to fruition in 2013.
Certainly had a great year in 2013, and I appreciate being back on just to kind of update you on what happened. So in Southeast Michigan, we had a great statewide event on bass fishing. We had a Bassmasters tournament, put $2 to $3 million in local economy in Macomb County. As you know, we're starting to manage Belle Isle as 102nd State Park. Our state park attendance is very strong, still 22 million visitors. We had a great year. At that, we actually were able to hire some additional conservation officers. We had talked about that at length for rural law enforcement. They got a great record on that. We restructured our hunting and fishing package, which went from about 227 licenses down to just over 40. So we can now say, go out and enjoy the natural resources and have a great time. Natural Resources Trust Fund did over 70 projects. And in fact, in Southeast Michigan, they did the Intergreen Beltway there in Detroit, about $3.4 million. The waterfront continues to evolve. We've got a great relationship with the Detroit Riverfront Conservancy. We had a successful summer youth employment initiative again, 1,100 kids, put them to work around natural resources. We have a great partnership with some veterans, Camp Liberty, Sharonville. In fact, that's on WJR. There's an advertisement about that, about how can you help veterans as they come back. So by and large, we've had a great year.
One of the big ones on your plate last year, Keith, was the land management plan that you folks worked on extensively over the course of the year. Now that land management plan is being reviewed and considered. Where are you on that?
Well, that's before the legislature right now. I want to thank Representative Wayne Schmidt, Representative LaFontaine, great leadership in that in land strategy. It really talks about the 4.6 million acres that the DNR manages on behalf of the citizens of this state, making sure we're good neighbors, paying attention to local economies, and making sure things like our trails are connected. You know, the governor talked about his showcase trail from Belle Isle to throughout the Upper Peninsula to Ironwood. And so how do you connect those trails? How do you make sure those are economic drivers? And that's really what the land strategy is about. But fundamentally, public land ownership in this state drives regional economies and important for all our stakeholders.
Well, that's been a mantra of this governor and a mantra of the DNR, the Department of Natural Resources, as well. The link between economic development and environmental stewardship, they don't necessarily have to be mutually exclusive. They can go hand in hand.
Yeah, and in fact, fundamentally, if you believe in place-based economies, keeping youth in this state and making a difference, there's no place better than Michigan. And as previously, as we talked about, whether it's the Great Lakes or being number one in fly fishing, number one in bass fishing, all the public land, this is a place where you can make it happen.
My guest is Keith Cray. He's the director of the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. Keith, you mentioned a lot of different things. Let's go back to one that's been much in the news. When we talked last year about Belle Isle, the status was very uncertain. There were a lot of political ramifications, et cetera. As of February the 10th, you're going to be in charge, and what, it becomes a state park, essentially? Is that it?
And that's exactly right. Come February 10th, it becomes 102nd State Park, and we really look forward to that occurring. We've been working in partnerships with the Belle Isle Advisory Committee. Seven individuals were appointed to that. There was no controversy around those seven individuals. It was really agreed upon with the city council, the mayor's office, and the administration. So there's seven committed individuals. Michelle Hodges with the Belle Isle Conservancy is the chair of that group. They hold their first meeting next week, and we'll work on Belle Isle and we'll get it right.
Now, what implications does the emergency manager and the bankruptcy have on any of this? Is this is that separate issue? You guys are in charge, or do you have to work in hand with Duggan and all the other folks down there?
Well, we will work hand in hand with the new mayor and the city council, because we cannot be successful on our own. But this is a lease that's been signed. It's been before the emergency loan board, so it has been signed off, and it will move ahead.
Keith, when I was a kid, we used to go to Belle Isle, play baseball out there on Sunday afternoons. It was a wonderful, wonderful venue. No secret what's happened to it over the years. But any kind of a snapshot of some of the things that you might do specifically as you ramp that back up?
So in December, we had a partnership meeting on the island. There was over 44 partners on the island saying this is how we can help, from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to Ducks Unlimited to Michigan United Conservation Clubs to Healthy Michigan. And so it was a wide array of individuals that can help. Second is DNR can bring subcapacities to bear on Belle Isle. Parks are a core competency, as I already mentioned, with our other 101 state parks. And so we're currently removing trees, or we've removed over 200 hazardous trees. We're fixing picnic tables. We're repairing shelters. We're making sure the trash is picked up. And so there will be visible and tangible differences when you get on the island.
My guest is Keith Cray. He's the director of the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. Keith, before we go to that Army Corps of Engineer report, we go back to Belle Isle just for a second, but Belle Isle and the passport.
Right. As individuals go on the island this year, they will need to buy the $11 recreation passport. That will get you into over 1,000 boat access sites and the other 101 state parks. We appreciate people supporting it, and it's a great way to support public lands management in this state.
Well, I'm a proud passport owner, and I can tell you it is really convenient to have those. I mean, you can virtually go anywhere for $11.
That's the best deal in town.
It's the best deal going. Let's get to that Army Corps of Engineer report that just came out recently. The long-awaited Army Corps of Engineer report came up with some conclusions, Keith, that a lot of folks, including yourself and the DNR, have been advocating for a long time.
Right, and there's no confusion. We need to pay attention to the threat that Asian carp presents the Great Lakes, and we've been laser-focused on that. We appreciate the Army Corps' report. We were in a meeting yesterday. Appreciate Senator Stabenow's leadership, Representative or Congresswoman Candace Miller, Congressman Dave Camp, Fred Upton. Our congressional delegation is focused on the Great Lakes. And so the Army Corps came up with 8 recommendations, actually only 7, because one of them said continue doing what you're doing, and that's not acceptable.
That's not an option.
So there are 7 recommendations. We have some concerns about the sense of urgency. Some of those recommendations take 25 years to implement. That is not acceptable. So we need to have some interim measures that will reduce the risk of Asian carp coming to the Great Lakes, pure and simple.
One thing that was particularly disturbing in that report, the Army Corps actually admitted that the electronic barriers were not foolproof.
I believe that report said 2/3 of the time that there's leakage in that, or potential leakage in that system. And so as we look at hydrologic separation, which is the end goal, is to make sure that invasive species go both ways, from the Great Lakes to Mississippi, from Mississippi to the Great Lakes. However, the impact of the invasives on the water bodies, I'll say, is greater coming to the Great Lakes than going to Mississippi.
So what are some things we can do in the interim? That separation is going to take some time, and it's going to take a lot of money. What can the Army Corps do? What can the states do? What can the city of Chicago do in the short term?
Well, let's start with what citizens can do. They can continue to raise the issue with their congressional staff and their delegation, saying this is an important issue. To the Army Corps' credit, they need authorization, and they need funding, and they need authorities before they can act. So it really will take the congressional delegation working with the Army Corps and those impacted states to have a unified and comprehensive approach. But we can't sit idle while we wait for perfect. We can't let perfect get in the way of progress. So one thing the governor's done is he did have that Council of the Great Lakes governors meeting up in Mackinac Island. Governor Quinn at the time said he was supportive of looking at some type of separation and increasing that vigilance. So we appreciate that support. I believe that the governor will continue to be front and center on invasives and the threat that proposes or poses to the Great Lakes.
You know, rarely have I seen such enthusiastic response to a federal report as I've seen with this one. It seems like people on both political parties, it seems like people all across the spectrum agree that separation of the basins is the answer to the problem.
Well, on Tuesday night there was a meeting in Ann Arbor. And to a person, they all agreed something needed to happen, and that we needed to act with some urgency. So it's great alignment amongst all the users and all the stakeholders.
Keith, you were talking about your Summer Youth Employment Initiative, which I've always thought is one of your real jewels among your programs. You're doing, you mentioned the number of people who were involved last summer. You're doing something a little different this year with the Michigan Civilian Conservation Corps.
So the legislature supported the Michigan Civilian Conservation Corps, and we all know about the Civilian Conservation Corps back in the day when they were putting people back to work.
FDR, in the 30s.
That's exactly right. Oh. And so we're going to meld the Summer Youth Employment Initiative with the Michigan Civilian Conservation Corps, work both in those four cities that have had some very significant problems, but also in those rural areas.
My guest is Keith Gray. He's the director of the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. Keith, I know that you don't have all the data in yet, but something much in the news, the recently concluded wolf hunt in the Upper Peninsula, not without controversy, but it seems like the quotas, you got about half the quotas reported, I guess. But what can you say about that, understanding that this is still preliminary?
We have concluded the first wolf hunt. Appreciate both the public input and the deliberations before the commission. It was based on science, it was based on conflict, and it was based on trying to reduce populations and change behavior in three units. Our initial goal was 43 animals, and that goal was a very conservative goal. It was not to impact the population of wolves. DNR's worked hand in glove with Fish and Wildlife Service to make sure that wolves were delisted. What we're attempting to do is to use hunters as a tool in the toolbox to reduce that conflict. There's a reported 23 wolves that were harvested. We only have 22 that actually have been confirmed, so we're looking at that 23rd wolf and making sure that that actually happened. We'll do the scientific data and rigor and research to look at age and sex and location and how that interacted with the various farms, the various interactions with human. But it was a very successful hunt.
Yeah, and you're confident then, I mean, nothing's foolproof, but the number of wolves reported were the number of wolves killed. Are people, you don't have vigilantes out there to your knowledge. I know you have officers out that are monitoring that. But, you know, sometimes people will say, well, those are the responsible hunters that report the kills. There are those irresponsible types that don't.
Certainly, we think that there was great hunter responsibility, and we trust in the data. There were a couple other wolves that were shot outside the area. Those were reported. Of course, there are still individual permits for nuisance animals on some of the farms. So all that data goes in decision-making in the future.
In the last couple of years, as Michigan continues to rebound economically, the DNR has received increasing support to do a lot of the things we've been talking about, Keith, from the governor's office, from the legislature. I know the budgets are coming up again pretty soon. The governor will talk to the folks here in February about next year's budget. Are you optimistic that the support's going to continue?
I'm highly optimistic that people invest in vision and outcome. And if you really want to make a difference, natural resources is one area in this state where we can make a difference. And so as we talked about, as we connect trails, as we make sure you have a safe and enjoyable experience in the woods, whether it's law enforcement, as we look at the invasive issue, I look that those are areas that are ripe for investment.
We recently had your colleague, Director Dan Wyand of the DEQ, on the program, and we did not have a chance to get into this issue at any length. We've got a few minutes here. There's going to be a renaissance in mining in Michigan, in the Upper Peninsula. I don't need to tell you the history of the mining industry has not been entirely a positive history with respect to the environment. I'm sure the DNR is all over this. Good for the economy? Is it going to be good for the environment?
It has to be good for both. And as we've talked about in the past, one of the things Governor Snyder did is that he put together a quality of life grouping, which was agricultural rural development, environmental quality, and natural resources, because no one of those can stand on their own leg. And so by making sure we're paying attention to natural resources, the environment, and the economy, I believe that we can have successful mining in the Upper Peninsula, put people back to work, and do it in a safe and responsible manner.
Well, the issue with hydraulic fracturing, we've been doing it for a long time in Michigan. If we do it the right way, it has had minimal, if any, environmental impact. See the same thing happening with the mining resurgence.
Absolutely, and as you talk about hydraulic fracking in the state, as you know, we lease some of the state assets, and we do that through a very public process. DEQ permits that, and we work to assure that there's no environmental impact during that process.
And the track record has been very, very good on hydraulic fracturing in the state of Michigan.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And as you may recall, there was a little controversy in our last lease about some of the corridor along the Asabo River that is non-development. We worked with the anglers of the Asabo, some of the interest groups, and actually we solved that problem.
Well, it's always a pleasure. I've been talking with Keith Cray, the director of the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. Keith, 2013 was awfully busy for you and your team. 2014 is not going to slow down at all.
We look forward to the opportunity to make a difference.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Please find us on Facebook by searching for Greening of the Great Lakes and follow us on Twitter at Green Michigan.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. We've all heard the expression, it's all about who you know. And wherever you are on your career ladder, having a friend on the inside can make all the difference. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, you're instantly connected to 500,000 Spartans around the world, many of whom are key decision makers in just about every major enterprise. Whether you're looking for a way in or a way up, your MSU Alumni Association affiliation can help you link up with that MSU alum who'll always take your call just because you're a Spartan. Building your network right now before you need it is the best possible career insurance. And joining the MSU Alumni Association is the best possible way to get the most out of your Spartan life. Learn more online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Joel Brummeyer. Joel is President and Chief Executive Officer of the Alliance for the Great Lakes, a multi-state organization that focuses on protecting our wonderful Great Lakes. The Alliance for the Great Lakes is also a member of Healthy Water Solutions, which is a coalition of Illinois stakeholders working to, quote, bring the state's water infrastructure into the 21st century. Joel, always a pleasure and good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you too, Kirk.
Recently, the big news, and you guys have been all over this, the long-awaited Army Corps of Engineer study regarding invasive species and particularly the Asian carp has been released. And you folks have studied that and you have a reaction to it. Fill us in.
Well, we're glad the report is out. A couple of Michigan members of Congress, Senator Stabenow and Representative Camp, were instrumental in getting that study done faster than the Army Corps said that it would be. So here we are at the beginning of 2014, and we've got some information in hand. You know, the bottom line in that study is that it tells us that separating the Great Lakes from the Mississippi River with a physical barrier is the most effective way to stop invasive species like Asian carp from getting into Lake Michigan and the rest of the Great Lakes, which a lot of us already thought we kind of knew, but it's great to see the federal government's engineers stepping out and telling everybody that, yes, that in fact is true by our version of the book as well. And so what we've got to do now is figure out how do we make that happen? And that's obviously something that lots of folks in the Great Lakes region have been talking about for a long time. One of the things that we think needs to happen, as you alluded to in your introduction, is that Chicago's water infrastructure has to be updated to get us to be able to stop the Asian carp, and those two things are going to go together. So we're going to be spending a lot of time figuring out how to do that.
Joel, correct me if I'm wrong here, but this is one of those rare instances in American life when Republicans and Democrats, regulatory agencies and environmental groups, and even a lot of businesses seem to be on the same page with respect to the solution to the problem.
Well, back in November, before the holidays, the 16 Great Lakes state senators sent a unanimous letter to the Army Corps of Engineers saying, how are you going to get the job done after this report comes out? Now, 16 senators from two different parties these days can't agree to sign their names to anything. And so we're seeing that Asian carp is about the only thing that that the Senate can agree on right now. That's a good sign. We've got to use that energy and that will to move on from studies to building something that can actually give the Great Lakes the protections they deserve.
Joel, before we talk about steps going forward, a few things about the report that I'd like you to comment on. Did the Army Corps, there was some admission by the Army Corps in the report that the electrical barriers are flawed.
Well, we got some really disturbing news released on the Friday before Christmas, as a matter of fact, where the Army Corps put some data out showing that small fish under 4 inches can actually school up and swim right through the barrier. And this happened in more than half of the observed events where it was possible. That tells me that the barrier isn't really a barrier at all. Last year we saw spawning Asian carp actually move 90 miles closer to Lake Michigan. So we're getting closer to that point where you've got small fish threatening a barrier that doesn't work on small fish, and the consequences of that would be disastrous for the Great Lakes and actually for northeastern Illinois. Nobody wants to see the Chicago River infested with Asian carp either.
Not to throw the Army Corps any more under the bus, but it's amazing now they've come out with this report about those barriers. But so for so long, they defended the efficacy of those very same barriers.
The electrical barrier projects have been an ongoing concern for more than 15 years now. And as some of your loyal listeners may remember, the electrical barrier was originally designed to stop the round goby, the fish that's infested the Great Lakes, from moving into the Illinois and the Mississippi River, and it completely failed because it wasn't done in time. It became the Asian carp barrier by default, and then over time there's been this series of testing and building and seeing what works and what doesn't. And here we are today with a big barrier that's very expensive that does a decent job of stopping some big fish and does a pretty poor job of stopping small fish. And that's just not a satisfactory answer right now. We've spent almost $100 million on this barrier project over the years. And so we're simply ready to move on to a solution that can actually give the Great Lakes the protections they need.
My guest is Joel Brummeyer. He's the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Alliance for the Great Lakes. His organization is also a member of the Healthy Water Solutions, which is a coalition of Illinois stakeholders working to bring the state's water infrastructure up to 21st century standards. Joel, we were talking about the recent Army Corps of Engineers report on the invasive species issue between the Mississippi watershed and the Great Lakes watershed. One thing they pegged in the study was the cost, and nobody is being too Pollyannish about the cost. It's going to be expensive, isn't it?
Well, a solution is going to be expensive because the state of Illinois reversed the Chicago River 120 years ago, and that's what's led to this problem. That connection between the Great Lakes and Mississippi River needs to be severed to stop invasive species from moving into the Great Lakes. Now, that's the bottom line. To get there, you really do have to invest in things like flood control and stopping sewage overflows and getting some of the contaminated sediments out of the Chicago River. All those things need to happen, and all those things should be happening anyway. And that's why we think that those choices have to go hand in hand with stopping invasive species. Just because we built this system one way 120 years ago doesn't mean it keeps on working the same way for generations and generations. And that's the decision point that we're at right now. The costs in the Army Corps report are drastically overinflated. It's sort of a absolute worst case scenario for every single thing, and ballooning costs go with that. Frankly, we don't think that those costs are accurate because they include work that should be happening anyway to protect the quality of life and the health of the people of northeastern Illinois. And we also think that where the costs are real, they've been inflated beyond reasonableness. And so about 2 years ago, the Great Lakes Commission and the Great Lakes Cities Initiative put out a report that actually put the range for separation between $4 and $9 billion. Those are still big numbers, but they're in keeping with other major infrastructure projects around the country.
Joel, you mentioned this a couple of times now, and I want to underscore the point. But from a political standpoint and from a public acceptance standpoint, the fact that doing this separation will also improve the infrastructure and the long-term health and safety of the Chicago water system. I mean, that's got to resonate with folks in and around Chicago who are going to have to deal with this during the transition process.
Well, that's why our coalition exists. The Healthy Water Solutions Coalition is actually trying to send that message that getting people out onto the Chicago River and getting that investment made is only going to happen if we stop the invasive species problem from becoming a Great Lakes problem. And so we've got an opportunity here for the people of the city of Chicago and the state of Illinois to step up and actually take leadership and ownership over this problem. And I think they're going to get the support of the entire Great Lakes region. I've never seen a time when we've actually had people around the Great Lakes region encouraging investment in one place to solve a big problem that threatens everybody.
You mentioned the political clout behind this separation. You mentioned the support of citizens and municipalities. The White House, frankly, I'll be candid, has been relatively quiet on all of this. And now that the report is out, do you expect some stronger support for separation from the administration?
I think that everybody in Washington knows that this is a tip-top concern for the Great Lakes region. It's honestly, when you see numbers like $18 billion in 25 years to do it, it's real easy to say this isn't going to happen. But the reality is those numbers don't tell the story of how we can do this. And so I think that the region, the states, city of Chicago, the state of Illinois, are going to have to step up and say to the Corps, thank you very much for the information, and we're glad you're here. Now we're going to figure out what solution is actually going to work for the Great Lakes. And I think if we do that, we're going to get an option that is buildable, that gives us the protections and the time frame and the cost we need, and stops the Asian carp from getting into the Great Lakes.
Then do you envision a combination of local, state resources combined with federal resources to get this done?
Absolutely. This is not going to be 100% federal investment. I have full faith in the states and the cities around the Great Lakes region that they have felt the hurt of invasive species enough for the last 30 years that they're going to be incentivized to pitch in. This is a regional problem for the Great Lakes. Frankly, it's a regional problem for the Mississippi River as well, which makes it a national problem. And I think we can pool resources and pool ideas to get to a solution that's transformational and not just a Band-Aid approach like what we've been pursuing with the electrical barrier.
I'm talking with Joel Brumeyer, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Alliance for the Great Lakes. Joel, let's turn to another issue that we've been covering on the show in recent months, and that is the matter of these invisible or almost invisible microplastics that are showing up with increasing regularity in our Great Lakes. I'm sure you folks are on that issue as well, but that's a pretty sobering problem when you think of the longer-term implications of something like that.
Yeah, we move more than 10,000 people out to the beaches and shorelines of the Great Lakes every year, volunteers who do things like pick up litter and monitor water quality. And one of the things we find every year is that plastics make up a huge part of what people pull off the beach. And not all that is because people are just leaving it behind. That's actually being washed into the lake through a variety of sources. It can come from stormwater, litter on the street that washes into the lakes, sewage overflows, and it can come from pharmaceuticals and cosmetic products. The microbead issue is actually a matter, we think, of a lot of plastic beads that are used in things like facial scrubs, and those go straight through water treatment systems and out into the lake. It also comes from the breakdown of all the other plastic junk that we leave on the streets and leave on the beaches and gets washed into the water. These microplastics are concerning for a couple of reasons. One is we think that they actually bind to chemicals, some of which can be harmful, and then get eaten by fish and can be mistaken for food and then play a role in concentrating those chemicals up the food chain. And the other reason we're concerned, of course, is because anytime you have an unregulated contaminant going into the water, you've got to start asking questions about impacts to human health. And that's we're at very early stages of trying to sort through that. But the bottom line is we've got higher concentrations of plastics circulating in the Great Lakes than anywhere in the oceans in the world. And because it's a drinking water supply that is unique and unparalleled globally, that's something we've got to take very seriously and start to crack down on.
Yeah, I know some organizations, and perhaps yours, taking the approach that maybe the best way on to alleviate the problem is to work actually with the manufacturers of some of these cosmetic products, et cetera, and have them voluntarily remove those from the constituent parts of their different products.
It's, you know, one thing we know right now is that Washington isn't big on new environmental regulations, in case anybody hadn't noticed. And so working directly both with companies and with consumers who can actually make choices not to use certain products is probably the way to get at this problem in the short term. It's very straightforward simply to avoid products with microbeads in them. And in fact, there's a phone app that you can use to determine whether or not the product that you're looking at contains microbeads. So folks are starting to make it easier to make those choices. We're glad that some of the companies that make this stuff have actually already committed to phasing them out. I think that, you know, that train has left the station, and hopefully the rest of the companies who make this stuff will get on board.
Yeah, that app is called Beat the Microbead, and I believe you can get that from the App Store, and it's free of charge, right, Joel?
Yeah, it's done by a group called Five Geyers. They have been doing some monitoring of the Great Lakes and the oceans around the world, looking for these microbeads in the water, and are involved in a global campaign to just simply knock those things out of production so we don't have to worry about that source anymore.
I've been talking with Joel Brummeyer. He's been a guest on Greening the Great Lakes in the past. He's president and chief executive officer of the Alliance for the Great Lakes. Joel, always a pleasure talking to you.
Likewise, Kirk.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
MLive Media Group is a Greening of the Great Lakes partner. To read Kirk's blog and to hear our show archives, please visit mlive.com/environment.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Whether you're moving across town or across the country, relocating to a new job or a new city is always a challenge. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, wherever you go, you'll have an instant circle of friends on hand to help you get settled and get connected. With more than 100 clubs and affiliates around the world, there's a Spartan in just about every city. And as an MSU Alumni Association member, you'll quickly feel right at home. Wherever you go, community, connections, careers, and class, four great reasons to visit alumni.msu.edu today to activate your membership in the largest Spartan organization in the world. That's alumni.msu.edu, the Michigan State University Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
I'm Russ White for Greening of the Great Lakes, and it's a pleasure to welcome Dan Kiefer to the program. Dan is on the executive committee of Michigan Trout Unlimited. Dan, great to have you on the program.
Thanks, Russ. It's good to be able to talk with you.
Now, you just recently had your quarterly meeting here with Michigan Trout Unlimited, and I'm going to ask you in a minute kind of what came out of that, what concerns you guys as 2014 dawns. But first of all, tell us a little bit about Michigan Trout Unlimited, who you are and what you do.
Trout Unlimited is now a national organization. It was started in 1959, and what's special about it has its roots here in Michigan. It was founded on the banks of the Isabel River, grew here, created the idea that if you take care of the rivers and streams, the fish take care of themselves, and just a very conservation-oriented, beyond just catching fish, to taking care of our natural resources. It eventually grew to a nationwide organization, now has 120,000 members, and it's based in Washington, D.C., but it has state councils. And I serve on the Michigan Council, which is based here in Michigan. There are 7,000 members of TU here in Michigan. They're all aligned with 20 different chapters around the state. And the state council takes all of those local chapters and what they do for fishing and conservation and deals with those issues at the state level.
So you recently had your quarterly meeting. What kind of what were some of the issues you're grappling with and working on?
TU is very similar to DU, Ducks Unlimited. Well, the first name people think of, well, that's just a bunch of hunters, or this is just a bunch of fishermen, and all they really care about is their sport. When really underneath it all is a whole lot of conservation. Again, taking care of our natural resources. So the issues that really we were dealing with at the state level, we're dealing with now, one is water use. Michigan, the Great Lakes, just has this incredible bounty of fresh water, but it is not infinite. And it supports an awful lot of our quality of life, a lot of our interests, not just as fishermen, but as cottage owners and riverfront owners and recreationists. A lot of the Michigan economy of recreation relies on our water and taking care of it. So we spend a lot of time. Our executive director is based in Lansing and spends a lot of time with the DNR and the DQ and the legislature working on water use issues. Michigan is, like with so much of our natural resource policy, we lead the nation in our water use law, and it's finding the balance between agriculture, industry, as well as recreation. So we're spending a lot of time on water use.
And Dan, I imagine that a couple of water issues, fracking and Asian carp, which we could talk about separately for a couple of days, but I imagine those are a couple of issues Michigan Trout Unlimited is concerned about.
Right, definitely fracking, as there's so much concern and immediacy because it's created a wonderful opportunity for Michigan and much of the country to improve our energy supplies. We are not at all against fracking. We support it. Simply want to see it done in the right way and done in the right places. And so that's what we're working on, to work again with the DNR and DEQ to see that it's done in the right way, the responsible way, and doesn't interfere with our groundwater, not just for fishing, but all river users.
Dan Kiefer, my guest on Greening of the Great Lakes. He's on the executive committee of Michigan Trout Unlimited. And Dan, we don't want to dwell on just the issues, but kind of as 2014 dawns, what's the state of the rivers and streams you and your fellow members fish in and on? Is what's the state of things?
The state of things is darn good. I'm currently retired, and I enjoy the opportunity to travel around and see and fish in other places. It is just amazing, the quality of Michigan's rivers and streams. It's just a great natural resource to treasure and to take care of. One of the things that another big issue to us is how we can and need to respond to climate change. It's happening. It's going to be here. How do we respond to that? And one thing that we think is a reasonable response is looking at our dams. We have something like over 2,000 dams in the state of Michigan. Most of them have way outlived their useful life. A lot of them are already causing problems when they fail. And the unintended consequence of dams is they warm the water. They drastically alter how a river works. And so by going about the proper removal of old unused dams before they fail, is a great way to respond to climate change.
It might, Dan, in a way, be a summary of what we've talked about, but what concerns you as we move forward about protecting our streams and waters, particularly in Michigan?
It's simply I'm taking it for granted. And, you know, it's all around us. It's very easy to take it for granted and think that it just takes care of itself. Well, it doesn't. And we all need to think about how our everyday lives, the things we do, our land use practices, how we consume things as consumers affects our water, so that we don't start to lose it as we go forward.
So, Dan, how can people who are maybe intrigued by our conversation get involved with Michigan Trout Unlimited?
Well, I guess the first place to go would be our website, michigantu.org, and just take a look at some of the things we have there in terms of our local chapters, the policy issues that we're interested in. Would be probably a good place to start.
And so let's leave people with what is it about fishing that you love, standing in one of these Michigan streams? What is it about it that just, you know, makes you so passionate about it?
A connection with nature that I don't find in any other way. Of you really have to read the river in terms of understanding how to be successful at catching a fish and watching how a river works. You never see two parts of a river act the same way. It's just fascinating how water in motion works and the whole ecology of it. Catching a fish is just sort of the icing on the cake.
Dan, thanks so much for joining us on Greening of the Great Lakes.
Thank you, Russ. A pleasure to be here.
Dan Kiefer is on the executive committee of Michigan Trout Unlimited. And again, the website is michigantu.org. What might be easier these days, just Google Michigan Trout Unlimited and it will come up. And I'm Russ White for Greening of the Great Lakes.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's indeed a pleasure to welcome to the program a longtime friend. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, a prolific author. Oh, and by the way, the new director of the Michigan State University Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. He is Eric Friedman. And Eric, how's that for a blind lead?
That is making me wonder who you're talking about.
Eric, first,
I'm glad to be here, though.
It's great to see you. Congratulations on the new directorship. I know you've been in administration previously, but this has got to be an exciting new challenge for you.
This is different than being a full-time regular faculty member, because there are administrative responsibilities, but there are also great opportunities to deal with students and prospective students and researchers in what's rapidly changing both the science and the field of journalism.
Let's talk a little bit, a snapshot of the Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. The title is somewhat self-explanatory, but it's got a proud tradition at Michigan State University.
It originated with funding from the Knight Foundation and was the first environmental journalism center in the United States. We do three major things. We prepare students to report on the environment, environmental health, and science, both undergraduates and grad students. Secondly, we do our own research. So my colleague Bruno Takahashi looks at media coverage of environmental issues, especially climate change, and now he's starting some studies that are looking at fracking and at the use of scientific experts as news sources. I do interview-based research with journalists in the former Soviet Union, mostly in Central Asia, on how they cover environment and other controversial issues of public policy. And the third thing we do is reach out to train professional journalists on how to cover the environment better and to reach out to scientists and how they can communicate what they do better using the media. So, for example, we did training last summer at Kellogg Biological Station for scientists.
You know, you mentioned science and journalism. When we were going through our programs, and I know you subsequently got a master's degree in resource development, but as I look back on my English program, and maybe you look back on your journalism program, I wish I would have had more science in my curriculum than I did.
One of the things that's interesting about journalism students in general is they like to write or to communicate, whether it's words, whether it's on tape, whether it's by visual imagery, photography, or graphics. But they say science is hard. And there was a great article in The Onion, the satirical newspaper, a few years ago that I clipped out about a national scientific study that said, NSF said, surveys show science is hard. But science is part of our lives. It's the technology. We use it to control our garage doors, our television sets. We carry around smartphones. All that's technology. New medications, technology. The vehicles we drive, the fuel efficiency, the power outages that we had. All that involves science and environment.
You know, though, Eric, and the science is becoming more complex as well. When you think about things like fuel cell technology or GMOs or any kind of genetic manipulation or the whole issue surrounding climate change, I mean, it is very difficult. I mean, what do your students do to try and capture that in a way that they can communicate it to the educated layman?
Several things that I do. One, have them ask the scientists, what would you tell your great Aunt Martha if you're at Sunday dinner and she says, well, honey, what are you working on this week? Second, give us examples. Give us anecdotes. Tell us what it might mean to the individual or to the industry or to the university or to the community. Third thing I tell them is talk to other experts, not just those involved in a specific research project. So if they're writing a news article about a study that was done by MSU neuroscientists, we'd want to also talk to a neuroscientist who's familiar with the field but not involved in the study and who can explain things maybe in a different way and can also say, well, there were some limitations in that study or there's work going on elsewhere in Switzerland or in Canada that would build on or use the MSU research.
My guest is Eric Friedman. He's the director of the Michigan State University Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. He's also a faculty member in the School of Journalism at Michigan State University. Eric, one thing that has helped me prepare for interviews for this program is not so much reading journalists writing about some of these issues, but trying to find scientists who are writing books for the educated layman and see how those scientists actually boil down some of their things and get that perspective as opposed to the one that maybe we're more familiar with.
Oh, that's true. And again, there's one of the challenges is how does somebody, whether it's graduate school or your home institution, prepare you as a scientist to write for audiences of non-scientists? If we want scientists, bench scientists, those out in the field, those working in labs, to communicate to the public, whether they're interviewed or they're writing books or they're making documentaries, they need to be trained in the same way that they're trained with scientific methods and using new software to analyze water quality or air quality.
Eric, as you're dealing with these young people who are interested in environmental journalism and increasingly we might call it sustainability journalism, I mean, are you optimistic? Are these sharp young people with inquiring minds, they still got the right stuff?
We hope so. it's interesting because some of the students come into a particular area of journalism because they have a passion for the field. They're issue-focused or they're event-focused. And the sports journalists, police, people who want to be police reporters, there's some kind of passion there. They're not just kind of thrown into it, like, well, it's your turn to cover the city council. What we found is that the students who do the best would be doing just as well if they were interested in reporting on sports. But there's something about environment. But the complication is that I see us training journalists and professional communicators who shouldn't be advocates in what they do unless they're working for an advocacy news organization or for an advocacy organization on the news side. So we had a master's alum who went to work for WWF, the World Wildlife Federation.
Right.
Well, I expect that he is going to be an advocate in using his professional skills. But if you're going to work for mainstream media or any of the specialized environment and environmental health publications, print or online, you need to be neutral and objective in your reporting. And your audience shouldn't know how you feel about a particular legislative proposal, about a particular public service commission review of a plan for a nuclear power plant. That's not your job as a journalist.
One thing I want to talk about, because I've just become familiar with it recently, but you have a feature that your students work on and that you're involved with, mm-hmm. called Great Lakes Echo, and I'm reading that every day, and it's really a very valuable repository of environmental information.
We launched that 5 years ago in March. Dave Polson, who's the Senior Associate Director of the Knight Center, is the founder and editor of it. Content comes from students in our environmental journalism class. Content also comes from some professional writers we pay on a per-story basis. Some comes from partnerships like we have with WKAR, and a little bit is coming from journalism students at other universities in the Great Lakes region. But the idea is to present environmental news coverage that the public out there wouldn't get from their other mainstream media, and we're trying to make it less Michigan-focused, which it has been because that's where we are, and cover the other Great Lakes states and provinces more than we had. So we're working on diversifying the geographic spread and therefore diversifying the geographic audience for other media organizations to pick up our stories, or industry environmental advocacy groups that repost the stories on their own websites.
Well, I can tell you the Great Lakes Echo has provided me already, and I've been looking at it for a couple of months now on a regular basis, with several ideas for stories for this particular radio program.
So I'm glad that we are being successful.
I've been talking with Eric Friedman. He is the director, the new director, of the Michigan State University Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. Eric, let's have you on a regular basis to talk about some things, that the research and other things that you're working on. It'd be a pleasure.
I'd be delighted to.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.